It's been, I've made a few additions to it, and it needs more doctoring. But in making the additions, there were some typos. So if you have pens and pencils, can we correct it? And I'll give you a list of things. On page 1 of the 19... Let's see, that's... Where is that? Yeah, of the 1950s matters. That's actually the second page of the bibliography. Okay, it's divided up into some preliminary stuff, then materials of the 50s, materials of the 60s, and materials of the 70s. So there's page 1, 2, 3, and so forth of the 50s, page 1, 2, 3 of the 60s, and so and a couple of pages of the 70s. Page 1 of the 50s, William Burroughs, Letters to Allen Ginsberg. That should be not Bolinas, but New York, Full Court Press. You got it? See where? Under Burroughs. First listing under Burroughs. Anybody not find it? Huh? Okay. It's New York, not Bolinas, Full Court Press. Then on page 2, same page, I'm sorry. Neil Cassidy, As Ever. Not as even, but as ever. It was a typo by the typist. As Ever, Collected Correspondence. You got it? Then on page 2, supererogatorily, my journals are listed twice. Journals early 50s, early 60s. When the list was first made up, they weren't published. So on the bottom, they've got them repeated again. You can just consolidate all the information in one listing, so it doesn't get too confusing. It was published, edited by Gordon Ball, and published in New York in 1977. It said, Proofs in Sacred Heart Reserve Library. Well, that's long ago. The Sacred Heart is long ago withered. And that would be, let's see, on page 3, under Orlovsky. You have straight, page 3 of the 1950 section, Straight Heart's Delight, Love Poems and Selected Letters, San Francisco Gay Sunshine Press, 1980. That wasn't added in. And under Orlovsky also, Clean Asshole Poems and Smiling Vegetable Songs isn't listed, so you might as well put that in. Clean Asshole Poems and Smiling Vegetable Songs. Poems 1958-1978. I'm putting him in the 50s because a lot of his earliest poems are from that era, when he first started writing. And that's City Lights, 1978. Preface by Corso. Then in the 1960s, under Burroughs, add in the title of a new publication of Burroughs is called Three Novels. And then parentheses, Soft Machine, Nova Express, and Wild Boys. End parentheses. Three novels, parentheses, Soft Machine, Nova Express, Wild Boys. End parentheses. New York, Grove Press, 1980. You know where to get chairs? This one here. But there should be... If anybody else comes in, I don't know what to do. But that's New York Grove Press, 1980. And I should point out on that an interview between me and Burroughs at the end, done here last year on the way to the airport with Burroughs at the end of the summer, is useful to explain the interrelations between all the novels. I think there may be a copy of that, the original transcript of the interview up in the library, but an edited version was published at the end of this new Grove Press edition of these novels, which the interview is me asking Burroughs exactly which book goes where, what book is related to what. Can you, who is supposed to get chairs, do you know?
Ned was.
Oh, there are a couple in there, yeah. There's chairs over here, you can take, grab those two. Could you bring them out? Bring both of them out, in case anybody else comes. You might ask Ned to make sure there are plenty of chairs so that we don't get interrupted anymore. So, what I did was try to find from Burroughs what was the exact relationship between all the different texts he published in the 60s which were involved with Cut Up. What was overflow material from Junkie? What was overflow material from Naked Lunch? What was overflow material from The Soft Machine and Nova Express? And what were... And he gave me a very coherent answer, tracing the lineage, so to speak, of all of the writings and all of the books published, so you can get some sense of their interrelationship. So you might find that useful for clarifying and getting straight what the curve of Burroughs' career is, where one book begins and where one book ends, because otherwise it might be confusing. We have a... Maybe you could give out the reading list to Tom. He can have one free, he's faculty. Okay, then under the 60s, under Snyder, might as well list The Real Work, titled The Real Work. Are there more chairs here, and can we get more chairs? Yeah. Well, I'll wait a minute until we get a little more settled. Burroughs' description of his first meeting with another writer, Herbert Hunky. So Burroughs' first take on Hunky. And I will also use Hunky's The Evening Sun Turned Crimson as another coordinate for the early 50s, because the first compositions in The Evening Sun Turned Crimson by Hunky are 1948-49. So some of the stories in some of the notations, like of the appearance of sunset or dawn or the streets of New York by Hunky, the sort of the phenomenology of planetary consciousness, the personal perception of planetary consciousness by Hunky around 48, 49, 50 would also figure into this shared consciousness. In many tenement departments, the front door opens directly into the kitchen. This is Junkie, page 5. This was such an apartment, and we were in the kitchen. After Joey went out, I noticed another man who was standing there looking at me. Waves of hostility and suspicion flowed out from his large brown eyes like some sort of television broadcast. The effect was almost like a physical impact. The man was small and very thin, his neck loose in the collar of his shirt. His complexion faded from brown to mottled yellow, and pancake makeup had been heavily applied in an attempt to conceal a skin eruption. His mouth was drawn in down at the corners in a grimace of petulant annoyance. "Who's this?" he said. His name, I learned later, was Herman. "Friend of mine. He's got some morphine and he wants to get rid of it. He got some morphine he wants to get rid of." Herman shrugged and turned out his hands. "I don't think I want to bother, really." "Okay," Jack said. "We'll sell it to someone else. Come on, Bill." So that's Burroughs' first picture, first notice of Hunky. Burroughs' first hit on morphine. A few nights after meeting with Roy and Herman, on page 7 of Junkie, I used one of the Surettes, which was my first experience with junk. A Surette is like a toothpaste tube with a needle on the end. You push a pin down through the needle, the pin punctures the seal, and the Surette is ready to shoot. These were Surettes of morphine which were left over from World War II, which were being sold by Army or Navy characters loose on Times Square. In those days, much less surveillance and much looser scene. Morphine hits the back of the legs first, then the back of the neck, a spreading wave of relaxation slackening the muscles away from the bones so that you seem to float without outlines, like lying in warm salt water. As this relaxing wave spread through my tissues, I experienced a strong feeling of fear. I had the feeling that some horrible image was just beyond the field of vision, moving as I turned my head so that I never quite saw it. I felt nauseous. I laid down and closed my eyes. A series of pictures passed, like watching a movie. A huge neon-lighted cocktail bar that got larger and larger until the streets, traffic, and street repairs were included in it. A waitress carrying a skull on a tray. Stars in the clear sky. The physical impact of death, the shutting off of breath, the stopping of blood. Just in that one sentence, you get the whole key to all of Burroughs' later development as a writer. A huge neon-lighted cocktail bar that got larger and larger until the streets, traffic, and street repairs were included in it. It's actually an amazing description of a daydream or half-dream hypnagogic vision or hypnagogic dream, hypnagogic state with an image that simply enlarges and gets larger and larger until you fall completely into it in a dream state. It is a real perfect reproduction of the actual state of picture consciousness during a virgin opiate experience. It's a really good description of the first virgin opium on the nod. Very precise. But also what's interesting here is the collage-montage effect, which is characteristic of later Burroughs. And it appears instantly in his first hard-boiled prose. It's already there. The seeds of his montage, cut-up effects, are already present in his earliest, really precise writings, which are just simply just realistic, naturalistic noticings of the phenomena of his own mind and his optical experience. How many have read this book, by the way? Yeah. How many have not? Okay, so what I'm going to do is go through it and give 20 highlights, like this. Partly looking them over, I realized that they were keys to the development of his later writing, that the images that persist throughout his later writing, like hypnagogic images, are first introduced here. They're actually first introduced in one earlier text, which I'll see if we can get a hold of, the Twilight's Last Gleaming, about the sinking of the Titanic, the sinking of Western civilization. But some images come there that are used later on, but the whole gamut of Burroughs' vocabulary of hallucinatory images comes originally from Junkie, and once you know the roots, then you can see the recombinations and the permutations of these images and the humor of that in his later work. He meets Hunky again at the Angler Bar, called the Angler Bar, which was on between 42nd and 43rd on the west side of 8th Avenue in 1944-45, here called the Angle Bar. I began dropping into the Angle Bar every night and saw quite a bit of Herman. I managed to overcome his original bad impression of me, and soon I was buying his drinks and meals, and he was hitting me up for smash, change, at regular intervals. Herman did not have a habit at this time. In fact, he seldom got a habit unless someone else paid for it. But he was always high on something, weed, Benzedrine, or knocked out of his mind on goofballs. He showed up at the Angle every night with a big slob of a Pollock called Whitey. There were four Whiteys in the Angler set, which made for confusion. This Whitey combined the sensitivity of neurotic with a psychopath's readiness for violence. He was convinced that nobody liked him, a fact which seemed to cause him a great deal of worry. This will lead on to the talking asshole in that complains that nobody loves me in Naked Lunch. He was convinced that nobody liked him. A fact that seemed to cause him a great deal of worry. And Burroughs' first impression of tea heads of that time is pretty funny.
Excuse me, what's a goofball?
Goofball, Nembutal, or phenobarbital, a sleeping pill. Oh. I'm sorry, I took it for granted. In those days, they were called goofballs. What are now called, I don't know now, what 10 years ago, 20, this is 30 years ago, and what are now called the yellow jackets or downers. There is in this book a glossary, which I helped compose. See if we've got goofball in it. No, it was just sort of taken for granted that everybody knew what a goofball was. However, my one contribution to this book is the last paragraph in the book of the glossary. It should be understood that the meanings of these words are subject to rapid changes, and that a word that has one hip meaning one year may have another the next. The hip sensibility mutates. For example, fey means not only white, but faded or demonic. Not only do the words change meanings, but meanings vary locally at the same time. A final glossary, therefore, cannot be made of words whose intentions are fugitive. So, well, goofballs of that era were when they are now called downers. Are they still called downers? Mm-hmm. So, Herman contacted other tea heads. This is page 17. They all gave us static. In practice, pushing weed is a headache. Well, this, I thought that was funny at the time, and so did Kerouac, this particular passage. It was Burroughs' adventures trying to be a tea head pusher, a pusher of marijuana, trying to make his living selling grass. And this was his sort of cynical comment on the romantic idea of being, what seemed to me a very romantic idea of going out and being the criminal heroic peddler of weed. Herman contacted other D-heads. They all gave us static. In practice, pushing weed is a headache. To begin with, weed is bulky. You need a full suitcase to realize any money. If the cops start kicking your door in, it's like being with a bale of alfalfa. Tea heads are not like junkies. When I get that in the letter, I just laughed. It was such a obviously true and funny. You know, his idea, his practical idea, and the humor of it, you know, like being trapped with a bale of alfalfa, something that you couldn't dispose of at all. Tea heads are not like junkies. A junkie hands you the money, takes his junk, and cuts. But tea heads don't do things that way. They expect the peddler to light them up and sit around talking for half an hour to sell $2 worth of weed. If you come right to the point, they say you're a bring down. Right, give me money, give me the weed. If we come right to the point, they say you're a bring down, quote unquote. In fact, a peddler should not come right out and say he's a peddler. No, he just scores for a few cats and chicks because he's viperish. Everyone knows that he himself is the connection. But it's bad form to say so. God knows why. To me, tea heads are unfathomable. There are a lot of trade secrets in the tea business, and tea heads guard these supposed secrets with imbecilic slyness. For example, tea must be cured or it is green and rasps the throat. But ask a tea head how to cure weed and he'll give you a sly, stupid look and come on with some double talk. Perhaps weed does affect the brain with constant use, or maybe tea heads are naturally silly. I had such a romantic notion of smoking grass at that time, being 1950, so I was 25 or something, that these chapters and these pages came, like I thought Burroughs is really cynical and really intelligent. He just sees right through everything immediately, instantly, with no illusions. Because this, of course, is I had this sort of inoculation of disillusionment through Burroughs way back in 1950, but there was still the romanticism of the 60s that we had to all go through, with everybody sort of getting goofy with the tea head sweatshirts and a romanticization of the whole tea ethos. which we participated in somewhat ourselves, but not quite with the same idiot sentimentality, I don't think. Writing croakers, the doctors of those era, this is historically interesting, because it is 1945, 6, 7, 8, he's talking about, when there was a historical recollection on the part of the doctors that opiates weren't always illegal, and there wasn't always this sort of like nationalistic moral majority paranoid hysteria about junk and junkies, that there had been an era around World War II when, as in England, junkies were just sick people who went to doctors or went to the pharmacy, and bought their heroin or opium on an open market. And so that the number of junkies in America was somewhat limited, nothing like they have now, because the cash nexus has entered into the peddling of junk, and it's that cash nexus that causes the spread of junk more than the charm of junk itself, oddly enough. In other words, junkies have to go out and score. And because the market is so unstable, they can't go to a job because they got to meet their pusher at 11 in the morning, and the pusher's late, so they got to meet him at 2. So it's an unstable life, and so therefore you've got to make your living by peddling junk to other people. Like, I'm going to score, so I'll score for you, glass, if you just give me a little bit of money, then I'll be able to score, and I won't have to worry about going into work. So every junkie, therefore, wants to have some clients so that he can score for them and take his junk off the top. So that's how the cash nexus enters into the spread of junk addiction. However, this is Burroughs' description of writing croakers. Croakers are doctors. Doctors that used to write morphine scripts in the 40s. There are several varieties of writing croakers. Some will write only if they're convinced that you are an addict. Others only if they're convinced that you are not. Most addicts put down a story worn smooth by years of use. Some claim gallstones or kidney stones. This is the story most generally used, and a croaker will often get up and open the door as soon as you mention gallstones. I got better results with facial neuralgia after I'd looked up the symptoms and committed them to memory. Roy had an operation scar on his stomach that he used to support his gallstone routine. There was one old-time doctor who lived in a Victorian brownstone in the West 70s. With him, it was simply necessary to present a gentlemanly front. If you could get into his inner office, you had it made. But he would write only 3 prescriptions. Another doctor was always drunk, and it was a matter of catching him at the right time. Often he wrote the prescription wrong, and you had to take it back for correction. Then, like as not, he would say the prescription was a forgery and tear it up. Still another doctor was senile, and you had to help him write the script. He would forget what he was doing, put down the pen, and go into a long reminiscence about the high class of patients he used to have. Especially, he liked to talk about a man named General Gore, who once said to him, "Doctor, I've been to the Mayo Clinic, and you know more than the whole clinic together, put together." Unquote. There was no stopping him, and the exasperated addict was forced to listen patiently. Often the doctor's wife would rush in at the last minute and tear up the prescription, or refuse to verify it when the drugstore called. Generally speaking, old doctors are more apt to write than the young ones. Refugee doctors were a good field for a while, but the addicts burned them down. Often a doctor will blow his top at the mention of narcotics and threaten to call the law. Doctors are so exclusively nurtured on exaggerated ideas of their position that, generally speaking, a factual approach is the worst possible. That's a great sentence. Doctors are so exclusively nurtured on exaggerated ideas of their position that, generally speaking, a factual approach is the worst possible. Even though they do not believe your story, nevertheless, they want to hear one. It is like some Oriental face-saving ritual. One man plays the high-minded doctor who wouldn't write an unethical script for $1,000. The other does his best to act like a legitimate patient. If you say, "Look, doc, I want an MS morphine sulfate script, and I'm going to pay double price for it," the croaker blows his top and throws you out of the office. You need a good bedside manner with doctors, or you will get nowhere. Kerouac and I used to read these pages and say, "Burroughs is just so intelligent. You need a good bedside doctor with manners." I didn't know anybody, at that time I'd just gotten out of Columbia. I didn't know anybody around Columbia who was simply that factual, that intelligent, and with that much sense of humor. And I still haven't met anybody that's funnier than Burroughs. in these terms, like, not cynical, actually, just observant and no bullshit. Like, I'm from Missouri, because he is from Missouri. Simply no bullshit and a very good, generous sense of humor. An early image that emerges in Burroughs over and over was of that comes through all of his writing, and it began in the 40s, is in this one paragraph on page 28, when he's describing kicking himself, kicking his habit in jail. Oh, and then he got out of jail, and almost worse than the sickness is the depression that goes with it. One afternoon, I closed my eyes and saw New York City in ruins. Huge centipedes and scorpions crawled in and out of empty bars and cafeterias and drugstores on 42nd Street. Weeds were growing up through cracks and holes in the pavement. There was no one in sight. That's, I think, a great prophecy, actually. It's a very powerful image. Huge centipedes and scorpions crawled in and out of empty bars and cafeterias and drugstores on 42nd Street. Weeds were growing up through the cracks and holes in the pavement. There was no one in sight. The that image comes from Burroughs and his wife in 1945, 6, and 7, reading the Mayan codices and visiting the Museum of Natural History in New York and getting photocopies of the Madrid Codex. And one of the most fascinating of the images in the codexes, which then enters here into the prose and then goes throughout all of Burroughs' prose up to the present day, is an image which he drew from the Madrid Codex, which is of a man seated looking forward with a slightly intense expression and a small creature on the back of his skull or on his neck. And then in succeeding pictures in this hieroglyphic comic strip, the man's expression becomes increasingly empty and vapid and robotic and mild. And the creature on the back of his neck begins to assume deeper and deeper proportions of intensity and clarity and intelligence and power and sort of cruelty. Until at the end, the actual face of the man is withered and shrunk and empty, and there's this somewhat inhuman crustacean-eyed monster sitting on top of his head. So this figures in with the idea of possession in Burroughs a lot, or the idea of cancer, that is a cell taking over and replicating itself endlessly at the expense of the host. The notion of antipathetic symbiosis, that is a symbiotic relationship which is antipathetic, where the host is destroyed, like cancer. Parasitism. Notions of bureaucracy, antipathetic symbiosis and parasitism, that is the bureaucracy slowly draining the energy out of the society or out of the individual. Notions of a drug habit, the habit being a virus with a symbiotic relation to the host. Even sexuality, the human virus, say. So this theme originally comes from the, I'll get into that later, applications of that. But on the simplest level, it means sexual obsession, junk addiction, perhaps homosexual obsession, cancer, and police bureaucracy taking over the host, as we now see, actually. With with the latest Reagan cabinet. Now, description of junkies of the day on page 30. They all looked like junk. There was Irish, George the Greek, Pantapon Rose, Louis the Bellhop, Eric the Fag, the Beagle, the Sailor, and Joe the Mex. Some of them are dead now, others are doing time. Then he just goes into an amazing series of vignettes, character portraits, characters, as they are called in 18th century writing, short, brief, descriptive drawings or sketches of local junkies on 103rd Street and Broadway in New York, circa 1948. Because the writing is 51 or so, so I'm reading it, 50-51. So it's to give you a presentation of Burroughs' intelligence and mind right at that time. Joe the Mex had a thin face and a long, sharp, twitchy nose and a down-curving, toothless mouth. Joe's face was lined and ravaged, but not old. Things had happened to his face, but Joe was not touched. His eyes were bright and young. There was a gentleness about him common to many old-time junkies. You could spot Joe blocks away. In the anonymous city crowd, he stood out sharp and clear, as though you were seeing him through binoculars. He was a liar, and like most liars, he was constantly changing his stories, altering time and personnel from one telling to the next. One time he would tell a story about some friend. Next time he'd switch the story around to give himself the lead. He would sit in the cafeteria over coffee and pound cake, talking at random about his experiences, so forth, in some little detail, some little anecdote. Louis was a shoplifter who had lost what nerve he ever had. He wore a long, shabby black overcoat that gave him the look of a furtive buzzard. Thief and junkie stuck out the knot in front of your family. He's got no class to him. That's a pretty funny sentence. Don't ever invite him to your home. He'll take advantage. He'll go on the nod in front of your family. He's got no class to him. George the Greek was the admitted arbiter of this set. He decided who was right and who was wrong. George prided himself on his integrity. I never beat nobody. George was a three-time loser. The next time meant life as an habitual criminal. His life narrowed down to the necessity of avoiding any serious involvements. No pushing, no stealing. He worked from time to time on the docks. He was hemmed in on every side, and there was no way for him to go but down. When he couldn't get junk, which is about half the time, he drank and took goofballs. Fritz, the janitor, was a pale, thin man who gave the impression of being crippled. He was on parole after doing 5 years because he scored for a pigeon, a stool pigeon, someone an informer. The pigeon was hard up for someone to turn on, and the narcotics agent urgently needed to make an arrest. Between them, they built Fritz up to a big-time dope peddler and smashed a narcotics ring with his arrest. Fritz was glad to attract so much attention, and he talked complacently about his nickel in Lexington. 5 years, nickel. The fag was a brilliantly successful lush worker. His scores were fabulous. He was the man who gets to the lush first, never the man who arrives on the scene when the lush is lying there with his pockets turned inside out. A sleeping lush, known as a flop in the trade, attracts a hierarchy of scavengers. First, Burroughs had a lot of training as an archaeologist and anthropologist at Harvard. That was his MA work. And so there's a certain professional language, terminology that comes in here, like a professional clarity. A sleeping lush, known as a flop in the trade, attracts a hierarchy of scavengers. First come those top lush workers like the fag, guided by a special radar. they only want cash. They only want cash, good rings and watches. Then come the punks who will steal anything. They take the hat, shoes, and belt. Finally, brazen, clumsy thieves who will try to pull the lush's overcoat or jacket off him. The fag was always first on a good lush. One time he scored for $1,000 at the 103rd Street station. Often his scores ran into the hundreds. If the lush woke up, he would simper and feel the man's thigh as though his intentions were sexual. From this angle, he got his moniker means his nickname. He always dressed well, usually in tweed sport coats or gray flannels. A European charm of manner and a slight Scandinavian accent completed his front. No one could have looked less like a lush roller. He always worked alone. His luck was good, and he was determined to avoid contamination. Sometimes contact with the lucky can change a man's run of bad luck, but generally it works out the other way. Junkies are an envious lot. 103rd Street have envied the fag his scores, but everyone had to admit he was a right guy and always good for a small touch. So some sort of honor among thieves. Actually, when I read this, I realized it was a good deal more honor. And Burroughs' vision of these people was a lot more perceptive than, say, I was hanging around 1949 working in the Associated Press with a lot of very sort of square people who were reporting the news, quite distortedly, actually, at the time. And I saw that Burroughs' honor among thieves here was a lot more honorable and more interesting than the mores and ethos of the people I was working with at the Associated Press. Or this estimate of human character was a lot more perceptive and generous than anything I heard around at in the center of mass communications of America. An Informer, page 47. I'm reading from the Penguin edition, so these page notes are from that. The worst of the lot was Gene Dooley, a scrawny little Irishman with a manner between a fag and a pimp. Gene was informer to the bone. He probably pulled out dirty lists of people, his hands were always dirty, and read them off to the law. You could see him busting into black and tan headquarters during the Irish trouble, in a dirty gray toga turning in Christians, giving information to the Gestapo, the GPU, sitting in the cafeteria talking to a narcotics agent, always the same thin, ratty voice, shabby, out-of-date clothes, whiny, penetrating voice. That was the most unbearable thing about Gene was his voice. It went all through you. This voice was my first knowledge of his existence. There's a little story about him calling up on the phone or calling through the door. But also, Dick, the historical trip that Burroughs is on, and the historical perception he has, equating the informer, you know, the movie The Informer? I guess that was Burroughs was here informed by the movie The Informer. Victor McLaglen and was the actor, and John Huston was the director of a great movie called The Informer, about a fink, or rat, or informer, a bad character in the untrustful character during the Irish Rebellion, in a dirty gray toga turning in Christians. Burroughs' specialty at Harvard was actually classical history, and he read almost every major work of history there is on the Roman Empire. So his take on the American Empire is seen through the eyes of someone who's had a lot of exposure to the traditions of 19th century scholarship looking on the decline of Rome. And his interest in Spengler, it comes from that point of view, and his description of these characters comes from that point of view. In a dirty gray toga turning in Christians. I don't know anybody's ever projected himself empathetically back to the early Christian times and actually tried to visualize who the finks were who would be turning into Christians. This isn't really great. In a dirty gray toga turning in Christians, giving information to the Gestapo, the GPU, sitting in a cafeteria talking to a narcotics agent. And here all the imagination is just brought focused right there and then, sitting in a cafeteria talking to a narcotics agent, thin, ratty face, shabby, out-of-date clothes, whiny, penetrating voice. Someone who'd inform on you. Someone who'd turn you over to the law. It's like the opposite of honor. So there's a great sense of, oddly, a great sense of honor through this book. Even when people are being dishonorable, at least they know it. In fact, one of the climactic moments is when one character, I don't know what he's called, Phil White, hangs himself in the tombs because he never approved of informers and finks. And when he found himself in that position, he hung himself. There's a Confucian story, I think I've seen it in Pound, in the Cantos. If your son commits murder and he comes to you for, he's being chased by the law and he comes to you for refuge, should you turn him in or should you hide him? Guess what Confucius says? Hide him. Old humanitas. If it's your own son, you hide him. You don't turn him in. So this is the opposite. Because we're living in an era of informers. More and more in America. And it's simply contrary to human nature, to basic human nature. One of the interesting thing about Junkie is the take on informers, which you have in here, which extends throughout the rest of his books in his later career, and which is applicable to political 60s considerations and political 70s and 80s considerations. The notion of the informer, or double agent, the rat, I think, the troublemaker, the agent provocateur. So whole governments are composed of the Fink, the agent provocateur. Yeah.
I know of a Hesse scholar at Princeton who turned in his own daughter for marijuana.
Mm-hmm. A Hermann Hesse scholar, no less.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hesse was, of course, used by Leary as the idealization of the high artist. The dopey artist. Well, that was the informer. The most striking sentence in this book for me at the time, I'm thinking back 30 years, was as follows. Talking about taxi drivers in New Orleans. For one thing, New Orleans is inordinately noisy. The drivers orient themselves largely by the use of their horns, like bats. I guess it completely knocked me out. I said, what an uncanny image. The drivers orient themselves largely by the use of their horns, comma, like bats, period. The residents followed the next sentence, the residents are surly. The transient population, well, the whole, I'll give just a paragraph, it's just very funny. It's just that one sentence, though, which is the gem. But a complex pattern of tensions, like the electrical mazes devised by psychologists to unhinge the nervous systems of white rats and guinea pigs, keeps the unhappy pleasure seekers in a condition of unconsummated alertness in New Orleans. For one thing, New Orleans is inordinately noisy. The drivers orient themselves largely by the use of their horns, like bats. The residents are surly. The transient population is completely miscellaneous and unrelated, so that you never know what sort of behavior to expect from anybody. The borough's the aristocrat. You never know what sort of behavior to expect. the element of the St. Louis aristocrat that comes through this always as part of the tone, the Harvard graduate, and the sign of the Eddie Machine family, is one of the funnier elements. But this very strange guy saying the drivers orient themselves largely by the use of their horns like bats. It blew Kerouac's mind. Wondering when he saw that, because it was such a perceptive sentence. It was to the point where the prose was like poetry, something like Saint-Jean Perse's Anabas, if you know that text, translated by T.S. Eliot, which is worth reading, and which is an influence on Burroughs. Anabasis by Saint-Jean Perse, a 20th century French poet, who wrote prose poetry in the style of Rimbaud's Illuminations. And of course, Rimbaud's Illuminations and Season in Hell has this kind of alert, factual imagery that's so factual that it becomes poetry merely by its factualness, or perhaps because the perceiver is so smart that he puts these unrelated facts together. Yes, it's true in New Orleans, drivers use horns a lot. You know, and it is also true that bats orient themselves by little squeaks of radar. But for him to think of that, put that together, and to compare the human beings to a bunch of bats like that, or to get that uncanny, that sense of the infrahuman, took an anthropologist in a way, I would say. There's something about it, an anthropologist or a medical student, both of which were Burroughs's specialties. What has he got to say about fags? Very funny description of as a homosexual, what is his relation to the whole homosexual world? Here's a take on a gay bar known in those days as a fag bar in New Orleans. In the French Quarter, this is page 72. In the French Quarter, there are several queer bars so full every night the fags spill out on the sidewalk. A room full of fags gives me the horrors. They jerk around like puppets on invisible strings, galvanized into hideous activity that is the negation of everything living and spontaneous. The live human being has moved out of these bodies long ago, but something has moved in when the original tenant moved out. Fags are ventriloquist dummies who have moved in and taken over the ventriloquist. The dummy sits in a queer bar nursing his beer and uncontrollably yapping out of his rigid doll face. It's really... pretty much a self-put-down. We're trying to avoid guilt by association, I guess. And there's another page 107 and 108. Well, actually, a bit of a 105. Parallel stanza, but not about fags, but about healthy American entrepreneurs. Same take, actually. Exactly the same take, but this is about the American entrepreneurs. A description of the Rio Grande Valley agricultural investment scams of the late 40s. It was in the Rio Grande Valley when the government was providing water and irrigation. Land was cheap. People were buying up land. And then hiring people to farm the land. It was sort of like bank farming or investment farming. You didn't have to do any work, you just had to have the money, put the money in, and somebody else did all the work. A three-lane highway, this is a longish passage, a bit of odd intrusion into this book, which is about junk and junkies, but this is a long section of sociology, an analysis of the whole Rio Grande Valley irrigation agronomy. A three-lane highway runs from Brownsville to Mission, and the towns of the valley strung out along this highway. There are no cities in the valley, and no country. The area is a vast suburb of flimsy houses. Because this is pretty prophetic, because people began criticizing that kind of suburban architecture and flimsy construction only in the 60s, really heavily. Well, the specialists had noticed back in the 40s, but this is the late 40s when he's seeing directly. The valley is flat as a table. Nothing grows there but crops, citrus and palms brought down from California. A hot, dry wind starts every afternoon and blows until sundown. The valley is citrus country. Pink and red grapefruit grow there that will not grow anywhere else. Citrus country is a real estate promoted country, country of by-the-wee tourist courts and old people waiting around to die. The whole valley has the impermanent look of a camp or carnival. Soon the suckers will all be dead and the pitchmen will go somewhere else. During the 20s, real estate operators brought trainloads of prospects down to the valley and let them pick grapefruit right off the trees and eat it. One of these pioneer promoters is said to have constructed a large artificial lake and sold plots all around it. The lake will sub-irrigate your groves. As soon as the last sale closed, he turned off the water and disappeared with his lake, leaving the prospects sitting there in the desert. As put down by the realtor, citrus is a flawless setup for old people who want to retire and take life easy. The grove owner does nothing. A citrus association cares for the grove and markets the fruit and hands the owner a check. Actually, citrus is a risky deal for a small investor. Over a period of time, the average return is high, especially on the pink and ruby red fruit. But a small operator cannot ride out the years when the prices are low or the yield of fruit small. A premonition of doom hangs over the valley. You have to make it now before something happens, before the black fly ruins the citrus, before support prices are taken off the cotton, before the flood, the hurricane, the freeze, the long dry spell when there's no water to irrigate, before the border patrol shuts off your wet backs. The threat of disaster is always there, persistent and disquieting as the afternoon wind. The valley was desert and it will be desert again. Meanwhile, you try to make yours while there's still time. Old men sitting in real estate offices say, "Well, this is nothing new. I've seen all this before. I remember back in 28. But a new factor, something that nobody has seen before, is changing the familiar aspect of the disaster, like the slow beginnings of a disease, so that no one can say just when it began. Death is the absence of life. Wherever life withdraws, death and rot move in. Whatever it is, orgones, life force, that we all have to score for all the time, there's not much of it in the valley. Your food rots before you can get it home. Milk sours before you can finish the meal. The valley is the place where the anti-life force is breaking through. Death hangs over the valley like an invisible smog. The place exerts a curious magnetism on the moribund. The dying cell gravitates to the valley. Then an example. Gary West came from Minneapolis. He had saved up $20,000 from operating a dairy farm during the war. With this money, he bought a house and grove in the valley. The place was on the far side of Mission, where irrigation stops and the desert begins. 5 acres of ruby reds in a house in 1920 Spanish style. There he sat with his mother, his wife, and 2 children. In his eyes, you could see the baffled, frightened, resentful looks of a man who feels the stirring in his cells of a fatal disease process. He was not sick at that time, but his cells were looking for death, and West knew it. He wanted to sell out and leave the valley. I don't feel closed in here. You have to go so far to get out of the valley, he would say. Well, all the worst features of America have drained down to the valley and concentrated. Of course, this is the center of the whole Regan psyche at this point. Or this is a very early description of the Sun Belt psyche. All the worst features of America have drained down to the valley and concentrated there. In the whole area, there is not one good restaurant. The food situation could only be tolerated by people who do not taste what they eat. In the valley, restaurants are not operated by people who are cookers and purveyors of food. They're opened by somebody who decides that, quote, people always eat, unquote. So a restaurant is, quote, quote, a good deal, unquote. The place will have a glass front so people can see in, and chromium features. The food is bad U.S. restaurant food. So there he sits in his restaurant and looks at his customers with puzzled, resentful eyes. He didn't much want to run a restaurant anyway. Now he isn't even making money. So that's a little bit of an early perceptive Americana. And last, page 111. He's now in Mexico City, looking for junk, looking for a connection. And the passage here is the preliminary passage, or a preliminary sketch for another passage, which was the first piece of prose that Burroughs published after Junkie. First piece of real high prose, like prose poetry, published originally in 1957, in Black Mountain Review by Robert Creeley, a section from a letter which was called Interzone, which was a place where all potential diseases meet. Sort of, if anybody saw Star Wars, it's like the bar in Star Wars, Interzone. In fact, Burroughs' description of it is very close to, I think, Star Wars actually. That particular image comes from Burroughs, very definitely. Here is an early prefiguration of that interzone prose poem. Page 111. One day I was walking down San Juan Latran and passed a cafeteria that had colored tile set in the stucco around the entrance, and the floor was covered with the same tile. The cafeteria was unmistakably Near Eastern. As I walked by, someone came out of the cafeteria. He was a type character you only see on the fringes of a junk neighborhood. As the geologist looking for oil is guided by certain outcroppings of rock, so certain signs indicate the near presence of junk. Junk is often found adjacent to ambiguous or transitional districts. East 14th near 3rd in New York, Polydress in St. Charles in New Orleans, San Juan Latran in Mexico City. Stores selling artificial limbs, wig makers, dental mechanics, loft manufacturers of perfumes, pomades, novelties, essential oils, a point where dubious business enterprise touches Skid Row. There's a type person occasionally seen in these neighborhoods who has connection with junk, though he is neither a user nor a seller. But when you see him, the dowser wand twitches. Junk is close. His place of origin is the Near East, probably Egypt. He has a large, straight nose. His lips are thin and purple-blue like the lips of a penis. That's a really accurate description, though. That's amazing. I mean, nobody would think of actually writing that down except Burroughs. His lips are thin and purple-blue like the lips of a penis. The skin is tight and smooth over his face. He's basically obscene beyond any possible vile act or practice. He has the mark of a certain trade or occupation that no longer exists. He If junk were gone from the earth, there might still be junkies standing around in junk neighborhoods, feeling the lack, vague and persistent, a pale ghost of junk sickness. So this man walks around in the places where he once exercised his obsolete and unthinkable trade. But he is unperturbed. His eyes are black with an insect's unseeing calm. He looks as if he nourished himself on honey and Levantine syrups that he sucks up through a sort of proboscis. What is his lost trade? Definitely of a servant class and something to do with the dead, though he's not an embalmer. Perhaps he stores something in his body, a substance to prolong life, of which he is periodically milked by his masters. He is as specialized as an insect for the performance of some inconceivably vile function. It's a very beautiful purple passage for a hard-boiled book of fact called Junkie. Pretty good. The next sentence begins, the chimu bar looks like any canteen from the outside. Chimu bar. If you know Peruvian, I think it's Peruvian, pottery, chimu pottery. Bros just borrowed that image from Peruvian archaeology. Chimu pottery has a peculiar look similar to this that he's just described. So it's a very subtle book, actually. What would appear to be, it was originally called Junkie, The Confessions of an Unredeemed Junk Addict. And as I say, was published, the other side of it was this really flat, boring, naturalistic horror prose by an ex-agent. So there was no competition. You know, Burroughs was infinitely more subtle in what he was presenting than the entire bureaucracy of the United States, narc, cancer. So I would recommend reading that, early Burroughs. What time is it? Okay. Does anybody want to say anything? Because I've just been carrying on.
Can we open the window and get some air?
Yes, please do. Can somebody over there do that?
It seems like they're nailed shut.
Are they actually?
We could crack that door there and enter the
room. Maybe not.
Yeah, the door behind you.
They are nailed
shut. KK, yeah, the door behind you could be opened.
Yeah.
Were you startled by the visible change in Burroughs between the time that he left New York and back to pictures of him that he aged? His face aged an awful lot during that time.
Let's see, that would be what year?
I don't know, between when he left and did this traveling down to Mexico City and then came back.
No, it was only a couple of years and he wasn't that much older.
The junk didn't show?
53, no. He came back to New York around 53. Junkie was published around the same year. And then we began immediately working on... Junkie was basically sent in the form of letters or texts, or texts accompanied with letters from Mexico City or elsewhere. Then he went to South America looking for Yahe, and he sent me letters there, which I collected and kept. And then he came to New York in 53, and we worked on those and put those together as a book, which is now called In Search of Yahe, but it wasn't published or publishable at the time. So then I went down 10 years later to the same town, Pucallpa, in Iquitos, and tried ayahuasca out, Yahe, a hallucinogenic drink, and wrote him a long letter because I got totally disoriented. And he sent me a very intelligent answer, saying basically, cut your thoughts. Basically, just a good Buddhist answer in a way. So in 63, I went down in 1960, 10 years after him, and then I took the manuscripts of a decade later and put that together with his early letters, and then Ferlinghetti published those as the Yahe letters. And simultaneously, there were a series of letters by Burroughs on love letters. And those were assembled in the form of a short nouvelle called Queer, which he suppressed. And the manuscript may exist somewhere in Switzerland. I don't have a copy anymore. Then the next correspondence between 1953 and 1956 is fragments of routines, which he had started originally in the 40s, that are just made up stories, acted out as part of conversation. And those were, he went from 53 on to Tangier, and he was sending letters to New York, mostly to me, containing routines and anecdotes and fantasies, like this obsolete doodlers and the obsolete, or peddlers of obsolete or unthinkable narcotics, or unthinkable trades, from 53 to 56. Those letters have now been collected and were published in 1978 in Bergamo, Italy, in an edition of 300 copies. And then they exist now in proof and will be published by Full Court Press in a year. And I have a copy of a Xerox of that, which I'll put in the library. So they'll carry Burroughs's texts, epistolary texts, epistolary texts, because he's an epistolary novelist in a sense, from Junkie through Yahe letters through letters 53 to 56 when I was in San Francisco with Neil Cassidy and Kerouac and Orlovsky. And the matter contained in those letters was Naked Lunch. So the two books side by side complement each other, the personal letters to me and then the matter of Naked Lunch, or the matter that was formed into Naked Lunch. So I wrote recently wrote a preface describing all that, or trying to describe the process of composition. And that'll be part of the book that Full Court Press puts out. So I have a copy of the letters, Burroughs's letters of that time, which are really great, because they, Naked Lunch is one thing, it's one of his best books and it's very funny, but the man who wrote it is also simultaneously going through big Naked Lunch changes, going through habit and disillusionment and disintoxication and intoxication and disintoxication and emotional crises. And the matter in Naked Lunch is a byproduct of the emotional crises, fantasies related to his personal life. So when you get the letters put side by side with Naked Lunch, you'll have a full portrait of Burroughs as a human being, and he's like so totally human, it's beautiful. I mean, like really funny and sweet and vulnerable, because his mythology is, I mean, the image he presents of being totally invulnerable. So he had the nerve to present, to allow the letters out and allow his vulnerability to be very visible. So I'll put them in the library in a couple of days. I'll probably make use of them in the class and read from it in the next week or so.
When did he kick junk?
Number of times. But that would be about 57-ish, 56, 56, 57.
Did his writing...
And then got back on after a while and then kicked again. Well, he used to claim that he couldn't write on junk, but then after he read those letters, after 20 years later, he read the letters and realized that most of Naked Lunch was written while he was on junk or kicking it. So he had to change his word. But he was swearing up and down on the Bible that nobody... He was trying to be a good guy, you know, and say, not to encourage people to take junk.